Welcome to the Shiur in Ibn Ezra Pashas Kiseitzei. So the Sedra opens up with the episode of the Eishes Yifatsoa, the dinner of the Eishes Yifatsoa. The Jewish people go to war. One sees a beautiful woman from the enemy side out in war, and there's a heter under certain circumstances to take her as a wife, to bring her into your household. However, before the relationship is finalized, it says, you should bring her into your house. The gilchas rosha, she should shave her head. The asusav tiparneha, she should allow her fingernails to grow long so they become disgusting. The tira simlat shivya me aleha, she should remove the wonderful, beautiful garments that she wore before she was taken captive. When she comes into your house, in other words, she should just wear very, very simple clothing, not the gaudy clothing that she wore before she was captured. The yashma de beisecha, she should dwell in your house. Uvachsa es aviha v'es ima yerach yamin. And for 30 days, she should bemoan, she should cry over her father and mother. After all of that, then you finally have the right to be intimate with her, and to take her as a wife. But I want to focus on the next couple of moments, is the crying of the Eishes Yifatsoa. She should cry for her father and mother for 30 days. What is the nature, what is the purpose of this crying in which the Eishes Yifatsoa engages for 30 days after she's been captured? So let's start, before we get to Ibn Ezra, let's start with Rashi. We'll see that many of the Rishonim take considerably different approaches to understanding the role of this crying, the purpose of this crying. We'll see the Ibn Ezra's words within that context, and we'll comment a number of things on the Ibn Ezra that I think are striking and deserve being pointed out. So Rashi writes that Roa b'chiyasa, roa b'nivula, kedesha tisgane olof. The purpose of her crying, the purpose of, is the same purpose as is served by her changing into less fancy garments than she wore beforehand. The fact that she shaves her head, the fact that she grows her nails long, you know, again, not that she grows her nails long and paints them, she grows her nails long in a way that's, you know, unappetizing. She wears clothing which is not attractive. The point of all of that is the same point as the crying. Let this woman present herself with her worst foot forward so that this Jew, who really shouldn't be striking up a relationship with this woman, is turned off, and let him sever any kind of relationship. In other words, the point of the crying, says Rashi, is that she should be unappealing to her Jewish captor, and maybe things will stop. Yeah, captives can't be choosers, right? You know, you captured in war, it's not a democracy, right? It sort of ends the... No, you take the gaudy clothes away, you throw them out, right? It's nothing, not too much. I mean, again, it doesn't really fit, you know, it's hard to do this in America, right? But you know, she didn't really have much of a say in the matter.
The question
is, the guy didn't want to do that. Right, so there, you know, so the Bezdin can enforce, right, the Bezdin can enforce that he has to go through this procedure, right?
The model looking like that.
Right. Right, right, the model that he captured in war, right, but the Bezdin can certainly enforce it.
Well, there's kind of contradiction here, because if she's lost her parents because of, you know, war,
right, so she was captured as a civilian, it sounds like. In other words, you know, the Jewish army went into the city and just rounded up everybody. She was serving tea, you know, when she was captured, right? That seems to be the image that we have. She's not a soldier, right? She's she was a civilian and she was taken captive, and you know the one of the soldiers in the Jewish army is smitten by her. So you know she's wearing the fancy clothing that she was wearing when she was captured.
I understand they forced her to change her clothes.
Right, so you can't really force somebody to cry. I give her a lot of onions, I don't know. But you can't really force somebody to cry, but in other words, you're encouraging her to cry. In other words, I think the way Rashi would understand is that she'll cry for 30 days, that's going to be a natural result of everything that she's going through. And this was a woman who was wearing, you know, fancy garments. She had a wonderful life. And all of a sudden, she looks terrible. She looks disheveled. She's actually going to want to cry. You know, it's a result. You know, it's a consequence of the situation she's been placed into. And she's a captive, right? I mean, her whole world got turned upside down. You know, so, you know, in other words, when she cries, right, Rashi's interpretation of the passage is almost like when she cries, inevitably, you know, let that happen. Don't stop her from crying, right? In other words, that's a good thing. You want to see her, you know, in a pitiful kind of state. So if the Ezra brings this pshat, he doesn't attribute it to Rashi, but he writes, Uvasa, she should cry, Kedei lahasir simcha soba, in order to dilute the happiness that this captor has in her, right? In other words, encourage her to cry. You know, don't stop her from crying. We want the captor, you know, to be turned off by her. You know, which again is a similar shot to what Rashi said. Right, you know, true, but I guess Rashi is saying, you know, again, in this particular case, he's drawn to her not because of her measles. I mean, he's drawn to her because she's gorgeous, you know, and she's this gorgeous girl, you know, out on the battlefield. You know, it's a totally physical attraction that he has. So, you know, how do you break that physical attraction, take away her beauty, you know, take away her beauty, and maybe he's going to, you know, go in a different direction. Right, you know, he wasn't drawn to her because of her personality. He was drawn to her in the heat of battle because she was a beautiful-looking woman. So the Ezra's first shot is akin to Rashi. However, then the Ibn Ezra brings a second shot. He writes, "As obvious ima, she should bemoan, she should cry for her father and mother." So the version of the Ibn Ezra that we have is in karov, if it is close, which is a very, very difficult to understand. What does that mean? So there are other manuscripts of the Ibn Ezra where the word karov is changed to imhargum, if they were killed. Right, which in context seems to make more sense. In other words, the Ibn Ezra is saying the fact that she's crying for her father and mother is a result of what happened. In other words, they were presumably killed in war. Right? We're probably talking about, I mean, in all likelihood, we're talking about a teenager. I mean, that's probably what we're talking about over here. This Aishas Yifastar, right? She's probably a pretty teenager, a young woman. Right? So her parents were no doubt killed in the war. So of course, she's crying for her father and mother because they are no more. Yesh Omrim, we'll come back to that idea in a minute, that she's bemoaning the loss of her father and mother, but until we come to that point, the Ibn Ezra then adds, Yesh Omrim, Kizeh Abichi Alaviha V'Yal Ima Shelo Hisyahadu. A fascinating shot. Why is she crying? She's crying over her father and mother because unlike her, they did not get the chance to convert. After all, what's going to happen to this Aishas Yifastar? She's brought into the house of this Jewish man, and she then marries him. But what's left unstated in the Sukkim, but what is certainly clear in Halacha, is that the only way he's going to marry this woman is that she's going to convert to Judaism. So she's actually undergoing a conversion process. She cries for her father and mother for 30 days, quotes the Ibn Ezra from others, because she's bemoaning the fact that, unfortunately, they were not zocha to become Jews the way that she is zocha to become a Jew. Now, that's a fascinating interpretation, and certainly not what you would have said intuitively reading the pasuk. I would think offhand that she's crying for her father and mother, like we said a moment ago, because they were killed. She's not crying over the fact, you wouldn't think, that she's crying over the fact that they weren't zocha to become Jewish. She's crying over the fact that they were killed. Apparently, this Yesh Omrim holds that it wouldn't be appropriate for her to cry over her parents despite the fact that they were killed. Why not? So let's read a little bit further in the Ibn Ezra and see if we can extrapolate from what the Ibn Ezra is about to say, what the approach of the Yesh Omrim is. Well, the Sea Deity, it appears to me, says the Ibn Ezra, Shechayev kol adam b'shikul hadas l'chadet es ovid v'esimo b'chaim uv'amovis. It seems to me, says the Ibn Ezra, that every person is obligated by the force of reason alone, the shikul hadas, one is obligated by force of reason to give honor to one's father and mother, both in life as well as in death. The Tam Ubachsa, and based on that, the reason that she cries is Shetisabel Aleim Kemishpat Yisraelis. This woman should mourn the loss of her father and mother the same way that Jews mourn the loss of their parents, the same way that we have Avelus. She should have Avelus as well. She should observe Shiva. She should observe Shloshim, again, whatever that means exactly. Because after all, she is becoming Jewish. If the parents were killed, well, she was taken captive, she's now going to become Jewish. And in light of the fact, especially in light of the fact that she's becoming Jewish, it certainly behooves her to mourn the loss of her parents the same way that born Jews mourn the loss of their Jewish parents, because after all, the idea of showing honor to parents is b'shikul hadas, is something which is obvious and reasonable and logical, and even a non-Jewish person is obligated on some level to show honor to one's parents in life and in death. Yeah. Right, so this is, we'll get to that in the Ramban, but this might be akin to, this is actually akin to a form of gerus, which we don't really do anymore. There's a gerus of avodim, of slaves. Right, so a slave is forced into Judaism whether he wants to or not. Right, so here's the, so we have to talk about this. This is sort of a middle kind of category, but the practice is she's given the choice. You know, if you want to stay and become my wife, you're going to have to convert. If not, you know, if you choose not to convert, so then we have to end this relationship. All right, so in other words, there's a heter given to the man to be with her one time, but then thereafter she has to, you know, embrace Yiddishkeit if he's going to be with her. And if she chooses not to embrace Yiddishkeit, so then she can... Right, so in this particular case, it wouldn't be a forced conversion. We'll see that in Ramban in a minute. Yeah. Right, so again, we'll see the Ramban in just a few moments, and we'll flesh it out a little bit more. No, it's fine. Okay, so there's a lot going on in this Ibn Ezra, which we just read over now. So first of all, I think from the Ibn Ezra, from his comments about how it's reasonable and logical for someone, even not Jewish, to mourn the loss of their parents, I think you see from that Ibn Ezra how he's responding to the previous opinion which he quoted. The previous opinion which he quoted said she's not mourning the loss of her parents, she's mourning the fact that her parents weren't zocha to become Jewish. That's certainly not the intuitive reading of the pasuk. Why wouldn't you say that she's mourning the loss of her parents? So it sounds like that Yesh Omrim holds it would be inappropriate for this woman to mourn the loss of her parents, because after all, she's becoming Jewish, her parents are not Jewish. We know that Gershon is Gaya, Ketinok Shino Lov Dami. We know that when a person converts, they become an entirely new person, and they lose any halachic connection to their biological parent. So how can she sit shiva for her parents? How can she bemoan the loss of her parents? Halachically, they're not her parents. That seems to be the position, you know, that's first quoted by the Ibn Ezra. So she wouldn't be bemoaning their loss. What she could be bemoaning is the fact that they weren't zocheh to become Jewish, but it must be that that's what she's crying about. She's crying about the fact that they didn't become Jewish, because to cry over their death, you know, there's no halakhic sanction to be able to do that. In response comes the Ibn Ezra, and he says, look, it may be true that halakhically they're not her parents, but that's where he invokes the idea of shikul hadas, of reasonability, of logic. It's logical, whether or not they're halakhically her parents, but it's logical that she owes them a certain debt of kavod, of honor, both in life as well as in death, simply by virtue of the fact that they are her biological parents. That's something that's basic, that transcends Jewish, non-Jewish. That's simply a function of the human relationship between a child and a parent. And as such, there's the Ibn Ezra. It's totally right to interpret that she's going to mourn the loss of her parents if they were killed. She's not mourning the fact that they didn't become Jewish. She's mourning the fact that they were killed, because that's a reasonable and logical, basic human thing to do. And there's no reason to assume that this woman shouldn't be doing it. So this Ibn Ezra, this portion of the Ibn Ezra calls to mind a shuva from a Moshe Feinstein, where he doesn't quote the Ibn Ezra, but the issues seem to be the very same issues that are being discussed in this Ibn Ezra. Moshe was asked as follows. There was a woman who was Madayah, she converted to Judaism, and her elderly non-Jewish mother was very sick in the hospital. And it sounds like this woman, after she had converted, had basically really broken off contact with her non-Jewish mother. But now, you know, that the non-Jewish mother was in the hospital when she was old and she was sick, you know, the convert was contemplating what to do. You know, I kept away all these years because I didn't want my non-Jewish mother to be an influence on myself and, you know, my Jewish children. But here she is, she's sick in the hospital, she's old, you know, and she can certainly use my assistance. What's the right thing for me to do? So Rav Moshe wrote that, of course you should go and visit your mother and attend to her needs and the like. And Rav Moshe introduces the following concept. He says, it's true that there's no formal mitzvah of kibud av va'em when it comes to the non-Jewish world. Right? The Gemara is very explicit about that. The Gemara says that Kabbalah Sovichov Yashimecho is a mitzvah which is given to Jews. It's not a mitzvah which is given to non-Jews. In fact, the Gemara quotes the famous example of Dan ben Asina, right, who was a non-Jew and showed so much kavod to his father. The Gemara says that is an example of Eino Mitzvah Ve'Osa. That's an example of someone who's not obligated in the mitzvah and does it anyway. There is no mitzvah of Kibbutz Av Va'Em in a formal sense from a non-Jewish child to a non-Jewish parent. Even when someone is Megaya, the Shulchan Aruch says that they, you know, they show their parents some degree of cover. They don't need to do the full-fledged kibud av va'em. It's just so people shouldn't say, ah, look, you know, the guy converted and now, you know, he doesn't respect his parents anymore. People shouldn't say that thing. However, it says Rav Moshe, while it's true that a non-Jew, for that matter, a convert who becomes Jewish, doesn't have a formal mitzvah of kibud av va'em, there's obviously some level of showing honor to parents, which simply stems from the idea of hakara hatov. Person has to have gratitude to the people who brought him into the world. And even though that doesn't obligate all of the aspects of kibud av va'em, in other words, it doesn't mean necessarily that you have to stand up when they walk into the room. It doesn't mean that you can't sit in their place, etc., etc. But it does, you know, it does mean that a person should show a certain degree of honor and respect to their parents, even if they're not Jewish. Hakara hatov, great gratitude. So how do you know that a non-Jew is obligated in gratitude? How do you know that Hakara Tatov is a din for a non-Jew? So Rav Moshe quotes a proof to this effect from the Gemara Sanhedrin. The Gemara says that after Adam HaRishon sinned, Kadosh Baruch Hu came to him and said, you know, why did you do this? And all of our Rishon Mishpan, Ho'isha Asher Nasato Yimadi, Hinach Nolim in our Eish Ba'ochel. You know what it is? This woman you gave me as a wife, she gave me the fruit of the Eish Adas, and that's why I did it. And Kanan Chazal, you see, Adam Arishon was an ingrate. He was a couple he told her. So after Moshe, you know, obviously the Gemara is being critical of Adam Arishon for being an ingrate, for being kafo tova. But who says that a non-Jew has to be grateful? Who says that a non-Jew has a concept of hakara tatov? Obviously, you see that Chazal are faulting Adam Arishon for lacking gratitude. So even a non-Jew is expected to have this basic idea of gratitude of hakara tatov. It's a basic human instinct. It's a basic human character trait. Not limited to Jews. The Rebbe Shalom expects gratitude from non-Jews as well. And that applies specifically, says Rav Moshe, to the relationship between a parent and a child. Between a child and a parent. Even if the child doesn't have a mitzvah, kibbutz or aim in a formal sense, but a Hakaras HaTov demands that they have to treat their parents differently than other people. It's not right, you know, to call your parents by their first names. Right? Even if you're not Jewish, right? It's just that there should be a certain basic level of comfort. So that whole, so Ramesh says in conclusion, so that's why even though you converted, of course you should go tend to the needs of your non-Jewish mother who's in the hospital. That's just the basic hakara tatov which you have as a human being towards the one who brought you into the world. I think, just before I take the question, I think this is an Ezra, it is really saying what Ramesh says many, many centuries later. In other words, why is it that the Eishes Yifatzorah is crying for the deaths of her father and mother? And again, the Torah is not just saying that, you know, she will cry for them. The Torah is saying it's right, it's appropriate for her to cry for them. I, dear non-Jewish, right, I, kibbutz of aim doesn't apply in a formal sense. I, maybe Avelus doesn't apply in a formal sense. No, it comes with Misha, it comes with an Ezra, he says no. Right? Shikol Adas, very similar to what Rav Moshe says. There's a logical imperative for somebody to show honor to their parents, even if they're not Jewish. And that logical imperative applies to the Eishes Yifatzorah. That's why Vachos Avio Des Ima Yerach
Yomim. You have to say that the bride didn't have the obligation to have a choice. So, if we couldn't have a China against them, that, you know, we came into your land and did Christmas for you, and then you kicked us, you know,
Right. We expect the non-Jews to show some degree of gratitude in their relationship with the Jewish people as well, because it's a basic human trait, you know, to show gratitude.
But the thing is, at the time of Bakas Yerushalayim, isn't she still
right
at that point?
Well, it doesn't matter. In other words, whether she has converted or not, the point is that these are her biological parents, right? So, you know, she's showing Hakara Tatov. Right.
Why would you
say
that? Why
does
it say that here? I mean, she's crying.
Right. So why don't you say, of course she's crying, you know, it's just describing what's happening. So I think if that was the case, if it's just describing what she will probably do, and it doesn't have any significance, either halachically or in terms of something we want to encourage, the Torah wouldn't bother saying it, you know. The Torah isn't going to bother telling us, oh, by the way, she feels bad, you know, that her life turns upside down. I mean, we can do all of the imagination. Right, so I guess because the truth is, according to Rashi, you have the following kasha. Why do you say uvachsa esogiha ve'esima, that she cries over her father and mother, you know, for 30 days? According to Rashi, the whole point of the bechi is to make her minuvelis. You know, the whole point of the crying is to make her disheveled. So she has uvachsa yerach yomim, let her cry for 30 days. Right? Why do you say uvachsa esogiha ve'esima? Apparently, the Torah is telling us that we should encourage her to cry for her parents. And more than that, I would suggest, according to Ibn Ezra, the crying of the Torah in this context is not simply that she's shedding tears, but it means she should proactively engage in practices of mourning. Right? In other words, that the Lashon of the Ezra is should tishabil alem kemishpat yisraelis. She should mourn them the way Jews mourn their dead. So uvasa sabiyo v'efima yachyom, according to the Ibn Ezra, I think means she should sit shiva. She should observe shloshim. Madushin, you know what it means? Sit on a low stool. Practices of mourning that are associated with Jewish practices of mourning. Uvasa, she should cry, is a general phrase that refers to all of the practices of mourning. I think that's what Ibn Ezra is saying over here. If that's correct, then we have a very interesting chiddush halacha l'maaseh, right? And this comes up with people who convert. People convert to Judaism, and they lose a parent. So people have two different types of reactions to that scenario. Right? Some people, you know, very much want to keep it, on the QT. They don't want to advertise the fact in the Muslim community that they lost a parent because, you know, whenever a person says shiva, they have to do a lot of explaining about things, right? Oh, you know, you lost your father, I'm so sorry, which yeshiva did he learn in? St. Regis? You've probably never heard of it. It's a small place, right? It's out of town, right? Which shul did they daven in? Kind of hard to explain, you know? Right? So, sometimes people feel, that there are a lot of, there's a lot of stuff that comes out during shiva, and they don't necessarily want to open up their lives for everyone to see. So sometimes people, who are converts elect, not to publicize the fact, not to engage in any formal practices of aveilus on the loss of a parent. But there are other times where a person who is not Jewish and lost a parent very much wants to engage in practices of aveilus. They want to honor their parents in that way. They want the catharsis of feeling that, they have these terrible feelings of aveilus that they want to get out. So very often they'll come and they'll ask a shaila, can I sit? May I sit shiva for my non-Jewish parents? Would it be wrong if I sat shiva for my non-Jewish parents? I know in halacha, they're not really considered to be my parents, but would that preclude me from sitting shiva? The impression you have from the Ibn Ezra is not only is it not wrong for the convert to sit shiva or engage in practices of aveilus over a non-Jewish parent, it sounds like the Ibn Ezra is saying that's the proper thing to do. What's that?
Isn't
the
answer stronger than the
other? No, so in other words, if you say that it just means let her cry, okay, so right, it's natural. But the Ibn Ezra is saying, according to this chat, uvachsos of yodatima means that she practices the actual practices of aveilus. In other words, she's not just crying. That, it sounds like that's what the Ibn Ezra is saying. Again, I'll read you the lashon, right? She should mourn them the way Jews mourn their dead. So it sounds like the Ibn Ezra is saying not only is it, not wrong. Well, she was Megayer. She's Megayer basically coming here. When she comes back from the war, so she's the... So at this point, right, at this point, is she quite a Geonis yet?
I thought
she can't
marry him
I mentioned the Ramban before. The Ramban writes, in Rosasol his Gaia, the Chayfet Nasha Bevezda. In other words, what we're talking about with this whole situation normally is Halakhal Kizek Kulo Babur HaHechrich. Right? In other words, in this particular case, she's being converted like a slave. Right? In other words, just like a slave is converted against their will, so she's being converted against their will. Kanishkot Ha'avadim. What? She is being converted against her will, and that's where she has to go through the 30-day process. But as the Rambam, Abba Amrafa Salasayar, the Chayfet Nasha, the Bezdin, Kanishkot, But if she chooses, she really wants this, she likes this lifestyle, how then would tell us to miyad? Right? In other words, she could convert right away, and she doesn't have to wait for 30 days. The 30 days is where she, you know, is reluctant about joining the Jewish people. Right, but in other words, it sounds like Ibn Ezra might be saying one of two things. I mean, either he's saying that even in a case where she's Megayer right away, she's still Uvachta Zaviyaves Ima, she should still, you know, mourn for 30 days because of mourning, right? Or that even though she hasn't converted yet, in anticipation of her conversion, right, she should start, you know, acting commissioned Yisraelis. In either case, Ibn Ezra seems to be saying that it's appropriate for this convert, or maybe even this non-Jewish woman, you know, to be sitting shiva over the loss of her parents, which, again, if one would apply that halacha l'maaseh, would have very interesting implications. Okay, we'll pick up a little bit more after Meir, the Rechonam and Akasha Omer. Okay, welcome to the second week after this year, Ibn Ezra and Tarshish Kiseitse. So again, we're talking about this Lashon Vachta, Savio, that's Imor Yerach Yomim, that the Eshes Yifas Toar cries for her parents for 30 days. We saw the explanation of the Ibn Ezra that, again, at least according to one explanation, this is actually an imperative, and for her to engage in Avelos, in other words, it's appropriate for her to engage in Avelos, to engage in mourning over the loss of her parents who presumably were killed during the course of the war. Instead, it comes out, according to Ibn Ezra, that even a non-Jew, or even someone who has recently been the Gaia, is entitled and even encouraged, you know, to engage in Avelos over the loss of his or her non-Jewish parents. I just want to point out, you know, just in kind of rounding out the discussion of Savia Yasima, two other interpretations of what the role of this dechi, of this crying, is, again, different from the Ibn Ezra. So the Ramban talks about this a little bit. He quotes the Ibn Ezra, and then he quotes the Rambam and Mar Nevuchim. Harav Omar B'mora HaNevuchim L'chem Lo Aleho. That the purpose of this crying is that the Torah wants to show benevolence to this woman. The crying is cathartic for her, to allow her to get out her feelings. Because when a person is very nervous or very agitated, he can get out some of those nervous feelings through mourning and through crying. And during that time when she's mourning and getting out all of these feelings through crying, he's not going to force her to abandon her religion, and he's not going to marry her. In other words, when the Torah says, according to the Mar Nevuchim, it means allow her to cry for 30 days. Don't do anything before 30 days. Don't try to force her to become Jewish before 30 days. Don't try to marry her before 30 days. Give her a breathing period during which she can get all of these difficult emotions out of her system. And that way the Torah is actually showing a tremendous sensitivity towards this Eishes Yifas Toar, you know, akin to what Chazal said in Pirkei Avos, you know, don't comfort a person, you know, a person is literally have their dead in front of them, don't try to comfort them, just give them space. I mean, that's basically according to the Mar Nevuchim, what the Torah is saying. Give her space. Allow her to cry for her parents for 30 days. Here. Again, according to the Mar Nevuchim, I think he would be saying you have to give her 30 days. Because you don't really know that she's okay. You know, we need 30 days to feel comfortable that she's okay. Maybe you wouldn't be obligated to give her more, but according to the Mar Nevuchim, it certainly would be, you know, a laudable thing to give her a little bit more time, you know, before forcing her into the marriage. But, you know, the Torah gives a certain criteria because I guess the average person after 30 days, you know, will be able to get over it. Right, so again, there's a tremendous muslim in that Mar Nevuchim, just in terms of how we relate to other people. You know, when people have gone through a traumatic period of time, give them space, don't try to force them to do more things that are traumatic and life-changing. You know, just allow them some space to appreciate the difficulty. The Aldaiti, Ein Hatznai Lachmol Aleha, says the Ramban, I don't think the purpose of these 30 days is to show Rachmanis to her. Says the Rambam, I agree with the Rambam that the point of the 30 days is to allow her to get something out of her system, but it's not to get her trauma out of her system, it's to get her avodah zarah out of her system. In other words, let her bemoan her old life for 30 days, and after 30 days, she'll be past it enough that you can now welcome her into her new life of Yiddishkeit and of marriage to this person. But if you're going to try to force the marriage and the conversion before 30 days are up, so what's going to happen is she's not going to be ready. She hasn't sufficiently transitioned. She has, you know, she has to let go of the old life before she can embrace the new life. Let her cry, not because we want her to feel good. I mean, we're not opposed to her feeling good. But the point of the crying is not to make her feel good. The point of the crying is to get every longing that she has for her old life out of her system. Right. Now, how is it possible that after 30 days, you know, she's going to be, Right. So I guess there's different levels, you know. In other words, you're right. I mean, she's going to still think about her parents for the next year or so. But after 30 days, she's sufficiently separated from her old life that she's not yearning for the old life anymore. That's what the Rambam is saying. The 30 days are supposed to try to accomplish. And for the first 30 days, she can't stand the fact that she's in a Jewish environment. After 30 days, says the Rambam, she's made her peace with the new environment in which she finds herself. Okay.
Is that specific to this woman, or does that apply to any caregiver?
Probably specific to this woman. In other words, the one thing, remember, you know, this woman is being forced into being Jewish, right? So it's not like she really has a choice. But even with being forced, we need her to have time to get rid of the old. Halacha kama v'kama, someone who's choosing Yiddishkeit, I mean, arguably, you can argue in both directions. You can say that she's choosing, so therefore she could do it much faster. You could also say she's choosing, you know, so we want to make sure that the choice is a real choice. You know, maybe she needs more time in order to acclimate herself and make sure that what she's choosing is for real. Just needs to drop the other aspect. Right. Interesting. Maybe you could say like that, right here. Yeah.
I wanted to suggest that part of the reason that parenting wants 12 months, but part of that is coming to name. We see that there are losses that are from the transition to that greater than the loss of an elderly parent, a parent, people's parent, and the morning period is only 30 days. So maybe we have an bias to want to hear from parents who is not necessarily what you mean, but
right, Kibbutz Avraham, right, Kibbutz Avraham. Because Kibbutz Avraham doesn't apply in a strict sense, you know, right, right, you can definitely, I hear that. Yeah.
Jeremy
Maka. Yeah. Right. Right, so I guess the assumption is we may be talking, I think the Ibn Ezra says, by the way, that you know, if indeed they are dead, in other words, that the pasuk is meant to be understood in the sense of ruchos avi aviv esimah, it's necessary, right? But it's possible that we're talking about the Canaanite nations again. That's the Hebrew pasuk Ahava, right? You know, because what's that? In other words, the nations of Asar wouldn't come from the Canaanite nations. Yeah, not Canaanite, right? Right, 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 right. So right, so it's not the Muhammad of Yisus, right?
Isn't this a special method that allows
Yeah, but you know, Rashi opens up the Sefer by saying we're talking about not the Shiva Sahamanim, right? So, yeah, okay. I guess maybe the simplest answer to the question is Ibn Ezra's saying, assuming that the mother was killed in war, so that's the Vachos of Yaveshima. That's probably the simplest way to answer it. I just wanted to share briefly one other Ibn Ezra on a different topic for tonight. So later on in the Sedra, the Torah writes Perchav Gimel Pasuk Chaf Lo Tashich Le'ochicha Neshech Kesef Neshech Ochel Neshech Kol Davar Seyisha. Basically, the Torah prohibits usury. So Rashi writes on this pasuk Lo Tashich Ashara lilove shloite ridus lamalve. Right, the Torah over here is talking about not that the malva shouldn't charge ridus to the lova, but the specific focus of the pasuk is the lova shouldn't pay ridus to the malva. It's an Israel the lova as much as it's an Israel on the malva. Right, let's say the lova says, "No, I'm so happy for what you did. I want to give you ridus." No, you're still not allowed to give ridus. It's not something that mechila is subject to. The Achatacha Torah Lamalva is only in Vayikra, where the Torah says that the Malva can't charge Ridus. As Kastuchal Lashite Lo Beneshech, that's that pulpit there. Here, the pulpit is talking about the Lova not giving Ridus to the Malva. This is from the Sifri. And the simple chat, I think, in the Sifri and Rashi is that how do we know that this pulpit is talking about the Lova not paying the Malva? It's simply from the fact that there's an extra pulpit, there's two pulpit. One pasuk in Behar, one pasuk here in Kiseise. So why the two pasukim? Must I be telling you that one's in Israel on the Malva, one's in Israel on the Lova? But it's just from the repetition of the pasuk that you have, you know, the idea that there's an Israel on the Lova to give to the Malva as well. Chamza is in Ezra, and Kedarko Bakodesh, he brings grammar into the picture, but he brings in grammar in such a way that he explains the Drash of Chazal very beautifully. Says the Ibn Ezra, Lo Sashich is a Lashon Hifil. Hifil is a causative. You know, in other words, says the Ibn Ezra, ordinarily, if you just wanted to say, don't lend with Ribbis, you would say, Lo Sishach. Right? That would be the simpler form of the verb. Lo Sashich means, don't cause someone else to give Ribbis. So, in other words, don't cause someone else to violate the laws of Ridus. So says the Ibn Ezra, that's how Chazal know that this pasuk is talking about the Lova not giving Ridus to the Malva. Because, you know, if it was just the Malva not, you know, demanding Ridus from the Lova, that would be Lo Tishach. lo tashich, don't cause the laws of Riddiv to be violated, indicate that you're not the beneficiary of the laws of Riddiv. In a sense, you're engaging in a kind of lifneiva. By you giving Riddiv to the malva, you're causing him to collect Riddiv. That's lo tashich. And the Torah is saying that that's as usher as, you know, charging the neshech, the Riddiv itself. So you give a very interesting example. You know, don't be so quick to dismiss Dictuk. Sometimes Dictuk can be behind a drasha of Chazal. Wish everybody a wonderful Shabbos, and as Hashem, we'll see everybody next Wednesday night, if not earlier, for Parshas Tifavah.